From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week on Bloomberg.com, some blockbuster revelations. For the past 3 years, Bloomberg News has been battling the Federal Reserve in court to find out crucial details about the Fed's lending during the financial crisis. Though the Fed did regularly release aggregates of overall lending, it didn't disclose which institutions were borrowing or how much. Bloomberg finally won that case, and now we do know which institutions the Fed promised $7.77 trillion to, apparently with no strings attached, and in fact, earned some $13 billion on the deal thanks to the low interest rates. Bloomberg News' Bob Ivory is the first to say that Ben Bernanke's Fed is a more transparent Fed, but there's a difference between transparency and disclosure. True, the 2010 Dodd-Frank bill now sets a 2-year limit on how long the Fed can hide these details. But when lawmakers were discussing regulating the banks during the last crisis, they were almost entirely in the dark.
None of the senators or Congress members that we spoke to knew any of the details. So when we told them, for instance, that Morgan Stanley had borrowed $107 billion on a single day in 2008, or that Bank of America had borrowed $99 billion on a single day, or Citigroup had borrowed more than $90 billion, they were just as shocked as everybody else was.
Legislators misunderstood the depth of the problem and so didn't find the courage to actually deal with it. Now, I mean, it seems to me that that's the most serious fallout from the secrecy.
What the Fed secrecy did was it allowed the biggest banks to get even bigger. One of our sources was former Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware. He really pushed for legislation, along with Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio. The two of them, it was called the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, and it would limit the size of financial institutions. This was directly confronting what many people believe is the main problem in the financial industry that has survived the crisis and gotten even worse. One of the arguments against the Brown-Kaufman Amendment was that it would be punishing success, meaning that these big banks got big because they're so good at what they do. And they turned around and spent money on lobbying Congress to defeat the Brown-Kaufman Amendment. Well, the numbers that we uncovered show that it is not success that made them big.
What were the Fed's motivations for withholding this information to begin with?
One of the functions of the central bank, Brooke, is to make loans to banks that can't get loans anywhere else. They're the lender of last resort. And in the lawsuit, the Fed, along with a group of the biggest U.S. banks called the Clearinghouse Association, said that if this data was made public, that banks would think twice about going to the Federal Reserve to get loans in an emergency.
The banks were worried that there would be a stigma.
That's right. If counterparties knew about their weakness, that they'd start pulling their money and there'd be a run on the bank. What the court said, however, was that the public interest in finding out about this data outweighed any embarrassment or possible bad effects that disclosing the information would bring.
But if we cast our minds back to 2008, there was a sense, and not a totally unfounded one, it turns out, that a depression was possible, maybe even imminent. So your article isn't an anti-Fed screed, is it?
I, just like everybody else, like to get my money out of the ATM when I put my card in. And the fact that I was able to do that uninterrupted through the worst of the financial crisis is in no small part due to the Fed's actions. I want to say a couple things about that, though, and that is that one of the Fed's jobs is to supervise the biggest banks. And apparently, based on the evidence that we saw in 2008, they didn't do such a good job of that. And the other thing is that in a democracy, it's very important to have accountability, especially when you're talking about money with a capital T-R-I-L-L-I-O-N. It's really important to know where the money's going, and it's important to know how it's being spent and how it's being lent, where it's being guaranteed. And on that front, we had to battle for 3 years through the courts all the way to the Supreme Court to get this information.
I know that when we mention the FCC, we fear that people's eyes will immediately glaze over. And I wonder whether the Federal Reserve does that for the longtime Federal Reserve reporter.
What's gratifying to somebody who can talk about the Fed at a cocktail party and watch the C's part is that more and more people are becoming aware of what's going on. One thing that's really interesting for me is that this issue brings together the Occupy Wall Street people and the Tea Party folks. We received two tweets. One was from Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who is probably the most progressive congressman in Washington, and a tweet from Senator Rand Paul, who is a libertarian and wants to abolish the Fed. So you have, on both sides of the political spectrum, we're getting tweets in support of the facts that we have uncovered.
This secrecy may have hampered lawmakers, and now these disclosures may be bringing the nation together in mutual hatred of the Federal Reserve. What ultimately do you think is the most serious consequence of the lack of disclosure from the Federal Reserve?
I think the legacy of the secrecy is that we have basically the same financial system we had in 2006. And the fact that we did not change things in the financial industry since the crisis makes it more likely that we're going to have a crisis in the future.
Bob, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Brooke, really.
Bob Ivory is a reporter for Bloomberg News.
Two weeks ago, South Africa's ruling ANC government won passage of the Protection of State Information Bill in the lower house of parliament. Now it faces a vote in the upper house. If it becomes law, it will greatly expand the government's ability to classify information and to jail for up to 25 years those who expose state secrets. Critics decry the secrecy bill as a giant step backwards towards the repressive policies of the apartheid regime, the very regime that the ANC drove out 17 years ago as liberators of a new democracy. But South African journalist Eusebius Makaiser, who I interviewed on our show last month, says reports of the death of free speech in South Africa have been greatly exaggerated. In fact, he says, the debate over the bill marks a crucial stage through which all new democracies must pass. Eusebius, welcome back to On the Media.
It's an absolute pleasure to be back, Bob.
Nelson Mandela is freaking out. Archbishop Desmond Tutu is freaking out. Nadine Gordimer, upset. You, not so much. Why?
I'm also upset, but I'm upset for different reasons. What I am against is that the bill will, in fact, make South Africa more a closed society rather than an open society as imagined by our constitution. However, the implications for media freedom, that has been exaggerated.
Nonetheless, critics are concerned that the government will begin to classify material not on grounds of national security, as mandated in the law, but for anything that's potentially embarrassing. And furthermore, in the Pentagon Papers scenario, would be able to jail journalists for bringing to light something that the public has a great interest in knowing.
No, I think it's absolutely right. There are many problems with the bill from both an administrative law point of view as well as from a liberal constitutional point of view. So, for example, the idea that the state security minister can have unfettered power to decide which individual departments can classify information, that's a level of uncertainty that is not imagined in our administrative and constitutional law framework.
The media and political opposition to the ANC have been vociferous in their criticism, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of outrage among the general public. They seem to be down with this whole notion of reigning in government information.
I think the media shot itself in the foot, Bob, by focusing relentlessly on the consequences of this bill for the newsroom. And many of their claims are accurate, but actually the situation is worse. I mean, if you're in a local municipality and there's corruption going on and you don't know about it because it's been classified, not only have you been robbed of money that could have been spent on improving the sanitation in your environment, the schooling system, but you've also been robbed of making informed political choices in the next election. That kind of connection hasn't been spelled out. All we hear is investigative journalists might go to jail for 25 years.
under the Constitution, the Parliament is not the last word. That belongs to the court. You predict that this legislation, even if President Jacob Zuma signs it, is going to wind up getting thrown out by the court so that all of this fuss may turn out to be about nothing. You sure about that?
Yes, I will eat my non-existing hat if I turn out to be wrong. The bill gives too much unfettered power to the Minister of State Security, which goes against the precedent that has been set in the area of law called administrative law. And then when we bring in constitutional arguments about the right to free information, for example, the constitutional court judges will have a fun time deciding which of the many acceptable grounds they should pick from to strike down this piece of heinous legislation.
One final thing. Should we be concerned that the ANC would even go forward with this legislation, knowing that it's going to be doomed anyway? What does that say about the post-apartheid government of South Africa?
You would hope that an ANC government consisting of folks who have experienced oppression and a state that is not open could become champions of openness. So to that extent, it is concerning and disappointing. One also shouldn't be too hasty about being doomsday prophets. In many days, this is just the normalization of politics. When I lived in England as a student, when I attended Oxford University, there were debates there, especially after 9/11 in the States, debates about the extent to which the state should be given power in a time of national security interest for civil liberties to be suspended. In many ways, South Africans are having an unnecessary existential crisis about this, rather than just having this debate, variations of which are taking place in Canada, England, and even in America.
Eusebius, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Eusebius McKeyser is a political analyst, a journalist, and a lecturer at Wits University in Johannesburg.
Coming up, why many people hate journalists.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This past summer, British Prime Minister David Cameron declared that a public government inquiry would look into the practices of the British press in the aftermath of the News of the World phone hacking scandal. For weeks now, the Leveson inquiry has been hearing testimony from witnesses like Hugh Grant, J.K. Rowling, and the parents of Millie Dowler, the 13-year-old murder victim whose phone was hacked by the News of the World back in 2000. This week, Paul McMullen, a former deputy features editor for the News of the World, was questioned by the inquiry.
In your experience, how common was voicemail interception by journalists at the News of the World?
By the rank and file journalist, not uncommon. These journalists swap numbers with each other. I think I swapped Sylvester Stallone's mother for David Beckham, I think, for example.
McMullen described such tactics as pretending to be a teenage prostitute to trap a suspected pedophile priest, or luring the strung-out daughter of British actor Denham Elliot into prostituting herself so he could take nude photographs of her for News of the World. McMullen said that he tried doing more honest journalism as when he went to Iraq to report for another British tabloid, the Sunday Express.
Here I was in Al Jaba with the British and American forces, filing copy on a satellite phone in a chemical suit, and then to go through that for them to ring up and say, you know, the war's not doing very well, come back to London and do some showbiz. But I've gone to this extreme to try and do something worthy with my career, but the reality is it doesn't sell. They didn't care. They wanted more David Beckham fooling around with another woman. That's what the British public wants. So despair at the British public. Don't despair at the journalist who simply keeps the journal of the day.
You don't have to feed that appetite.
Someone else would get my job. I mean, this is what my great-grandfather was a journalist, my father, and now I am. I mean, it's kind of family tradition.
What was the experience like appearing before the Leveson inquiry?
I have to say I was a little bit nervous to start with because basically you're about to be ripped apart by one of the top legal minds in the UK. And they warned me that a lot of this is self-incriminating and you could go to jail. But I sort of didn't mind, because I thought the principle of freedom of speech, which is at stake, is more important. You know, in Britain and America, we laugh at countries like China and Iran for jailing journalists. And right now, as we speak, in the UK, we have 7 journalists under arrest.
Well, given the threat, you were nevertheless stunningly candid. Sarah Lyle, writing for The New York Times, said it was hard to think of any dubious news-gathering technique you hadn't confessed to, short of pistol-whipping sources for information.
What's wrong with getting the truth in any way possible? I mean, you just don't go up to a politician and say, hello, I work for the News of the World. Are you having an affair with your secretary behind your wife's back? You have to be cleverer than that by tricking them or by secretly tape recording them. And I have no issue with that at all.
There was a lot of discussion during the inquiry about the public interest. You said, what is of interest to the public is what they put their hand in their pocket and buy.
We are just a mirror to the society we report on. And that's why Murdoch is such a professional. He just wants to create the shiniest mirror that reflects society in the clearest possible way. If people really don't like the fact that we expose, say, a three-in-a-bed romp between Charlotte Church, a famous singer in the UK's dad, on cocaine, then they won't buy it and we will stop reporting it. The truth was, we were selling 5 million copies a week, and that was the biggest selling English language newspaper in the world. The public was interested in that, so we fulfilled their need.
Let's talk about the incident that really kicked off this whole round of inquiries and the ultimate closing of the News of the World.
Yeah.
And that was the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone. The News of the World hacked into her phone, and in order to clear space for incoming calls from perhaps the abductor, I don't know, gave her parents false hope that her daughter might be alive. It caused outrage.
I understood the emotion, but you equally have to understand that the British police are not that great. We have a little bit of corruption and a lot of stupidity. And it actually took them, in the end, 7 years and several more murders of other young girls like Millie before they found the killer. So I see nothing wrong with a bunch of bright young journalists also trying to find the girl.
What about the parents? The anguish that was being inflicted on them.
Indeed, it wasn't inflicted by the phone hack. It was inflicted by the mistake of deleting the messages by someone who didn't realize that that would bring the phone back to life. And that mistake has closed the biggest selling English language newspaper in the world.
The inquiry brought up the case of Denham Elliott's daughter,
oh, yeah,
which is one case that you truly do regret.
I do, yeah. After Denham died, she hit rock bottom, was allegedly doing methadone. And although she had, you know, like £500,000 flat that Denham had bought her, she didn't have any money to get her £10 bag in the morning. So she'd get up and go begging at the tube station. Here was a young girl crying out to be helped. And she met a police officer who didn't help her, but rang up the News of the World and asked for money because he couldn't believe that this is the same girl who'd walked down the red carpet behind Eddie Murphy with Denham Elliott, you know.
And you offered her £50 if
yeah.
she would come to your place and have sex. So you led her into prostitution, which she wasn't in that space for.
No, indeed. But she was in such a bad place that someone offered her £50 for sex. I mean, that's 5 bags.
So how do you justify that? Yes, she was a drug addict. Yes, she was begging. Why push her that extra step? Why take pictures of her topless?
I was keen. It was in my first year. I wanted to impress Piers Morgan, who was my boss at the time, and just wanted to say, not only have I caught this girl begging, but I've got pictures of her topless, and I've got her offering me sex for 50 quid. How great am I?
This is a pretty dehumanizing enterprise, not just for Jennifer Elliott, but for you yourself.
Yeah, that's why I feel terrible about it, not just because she killed herself afterwards, but I actually liked her as a person.
Do you wonder what's happening to your own integrity, that you're missing something inside yourself?
I regret it. 2 girls that I've interviewed have ended up killing themselves, but it wasn't the interview, per se, it was the fact that they were in a bad place, and that maybe pushed them over.
You also said privacy is just a space that bad people need to do bad things in.
in 21 years of tabloid reporting, I don't think I ever came across anyone who needed their privacy to do something good.
Do you value your own privacy?
No, I'm an open book. I'm not very interesting, you know.
Paul, thank you very much.
Nice to speak to you.
Paul McMullen is a former deputy features editor at Rupert Murdoch's now defunct News of the World tabloid.
Hunter Moore is the creator of the website isanyoneup.com, an amateur pornography and revenge site with an insidious social networking component. The way the site works is users submit naked photos of people, an ex-girlfriend, for instance, submitted, say, by a former partner who was looking for vengeance. Rather than just publishing a naked photo online for the world to see, Moore's site also includes a link to the naked person's social networking profiles. Not only does that process create more of a flesh-and-blood victim, if someone Googles that person, Moore's site will likely be one of the top results, making that unauthorized photo all but impossible to avoid. Moore says that the social networking component is a big part of his site's appeal.
I mean, you could post pictures of, you know, random boobs and penises all day, but just adding that social network to it just puts it to a whole other level.
A whole other level of reality, of lack of anonymity.
Exactly.
And of shame, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Tell me about the shame factor. People obviously are not thrilled, for the most part, to find out that they're the stars of your website on any given day. How do they react?
We get a ton of removal requests, obviously, but I hardly ever get any from any of the males that are on the site. It's always from the girls. Usually, they just freak out and they do whatever they can to get it off the site.
Has anyone ever succeeded in getting their photos taken down?
It's up to us if we're going to take it down, obviously, but usually we go ahead and take it down, especially because it is kind of revenge and stuff. You have a lot of angry exes, or sometimes, you know, somebody that you had a restraining order against, or a stalker got a hold of your pictures or something. We try to get those down immediately.
You know, it's not fair for me to characterize you as strictly being in the shaming business, because you're equally in the ridiculing business.
Mm-hmm.
People send you shots, and if you don't deem them attractive enough, it's open season, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what people want to see, and I give it to them.
Now, what you're doing isn't illegal. What is the underlying statute that protects you from legal action?
A lot of people call it a loophole, but, you know, there's the Decency Act of, you know, 96 that protects me, you know, just from users submitting anonymously. Even if I do edit it, it still protects me because it was submitted anonymously by another reader or user.
That's the Communications Decency Act of 96, right?
Yeah.
Section 230.
Yeah. And then also with the copyright issue, you know, a lot of people send me DMCA requests. And
they say, I own this photo. You have no right to display it. Please take it down.
Yes. But when you take a picture of yourself in the mirror, it was intended for somebody else. So actually the person you sent the picture to actually owns that picture, because it was intended as a gift. So whatever that person does with the picture, you don't even own the nude picture of yourself anymore. But when you go to my site and you fill out the contract, I don't want any of the copyrights or anything. You actually take full responsibility for any content that's submitted. So that's how I'm protected.
Yeah, congratulations on that. Now, we've discussed that the people whose photos wind up on your website are in varying degrees shamed, appalled, horrified, shattered. So understanding that, why do you hurt people?
I actually don't. They hurt themselves, and I'm just making a profit off of it.
That's everything but true.
No, I mean, I give a stage for people to put that content on the web, but it's 2011. I mean, people, they're putting their lives on Facebook and Twitter, and then they expect to send these private, intimate photos to random people that they're meeting online that they don't know, and they expect it to not be on the internet.
Has there been any individual victim who you've just felt sorry for to the point that you were moved to take something down and you know, even, oh, I don't know, apologize for the embarrassment that she's undergone, or he?
I mean, that's happened a million times, I'd say. I felt really bad about a lot of things. I don't just do the posting, so sometimes stuff goes up and you know, I'll see it later on and I'll feel bad, or I'll be reading a removal request and I'll feel really bad. I've had points where I felt so bad I've wanted to stop the site, to be honest with you.
And what stopped you from stopping?
It's just too much fun. I get paid money to throw parties, and I get paid money to sit in front of my computer and look at all my peers naked, so it's pretty awesome.
If you got nude photos of your sister or your mom, would you post them?
No, of course not. Why would I post pictures of my sister or my mom?
Well, why wouldn't you?
What would you want to see your mom naked? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's, why would I post pictures of my family naked? I thank God it's my site. I mean, I wouldn't. Why would I post pictures of my sister? That's crazy.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Hunter, we're done.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for speaking to us.
All right, cool. Thanks for having me.
Hunter Moore is the creator of the website isanyoneup.com.
Teenagers are often thought of as careless when it comes to what they post online and in need of protection by adults. But a new study from the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project suggests otherwise. Mary Madden is a senior research specialist at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. Mary, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how do the expectations teenagers have about privacy online compare to the expectations that adults have?
Well, most teens are taking active steps to manage their privacy and reputations online. Like adults, they may not always be as careful as they should be, but we don't see evidence that suggests a complete generational shift in attitudes and practice. More than half of teen social media users say they thought about posting something, and then they thought about the potential future ramifications. One thing we heard in our focus groups is that friending is often the first line of defense in managing privacy online. Just that act of deciding who you allow in your network is a very important step. Just 17% of teen social media users say that their profile is completely public.
What does that mean?
For teens, the most popular social network is Facebook. And there is basically a general setting that allows everyone to see the things that you post. They tell us that for the most part, they're restricting who sees their posts to friends only. Teenagers, like adults, tend to set and forget. They want to choose a setting that allows them to not have to think about this, quite frankly, every time they want to post something. But they also have a variety of ways to customize and cloak their messaging on social media. Teens use private messaging channels, they use slang, they use jokes that may only be understood by peers. So just because someone is posting something broadly to a network, it may not actually be intended for everyone in the network.
What does your study suggest about the practice of sexting, which is something the media love to talk about? That's the creating, sharing, and forwarding of nude or nearly nude images by teens. There are personal risks and even legal risks when kids do this. Are they aware of them?
What we found in this latest study is that just 2% of all teens ages 12 to 17 say they've sent a sexually suggestive nude or nearly nude photo or video of themselves to someone else. Now, that represents about 3% of all teen cell users and has remained stable since 2009. They're, of course, much more likely to say that they have received one of these messages or images. However, it's still a small group. We're talking about 1 in 6 for the teen who may have been the subject of one of these messages or photos. It can be a horrifying experience. It can also get them into a lot of trouble. But we're not seeing evidence that this is incredibly pervasive.
So what is the moral of the story of this study for parents who are listening right now?
This study was part of a broader effort to look at the positive and negative experiences teens have on social network sites, and what kinds of guidance they receive about appropriate behavior online. So we felt that understanding the privacy choices that teens make was one part of that story. It helps us to understand the level of publicity that accompanies their interaction in these spaces. And for the most part, kids feel that these are mostly kind spaces. It's definitely a minority that are being directly targeted in these spaces. Most teens have witnessed some kind of mean or cruel behavior online, but few are experiencing it firsthand. Many of them are telling us that they stand up for their friends online, and many of them are talking to their parents about the things that they witness. There are certainly bad actors in these spaces, but the good news is that teens are rising to the occasion.
Mary, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Madden is a senior research specialist at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project.
Coming up, cyber war. Imminent or overrated?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. Constant Contact, offering email marketing tools to promote small businesses during the holiday season. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, the media were buzzing about a broken water pump in Illinois, allegedly due to Russian hackers breaking into the control system of a water utility. It would have been the first known instance of hackers using cyber warfare to destroy a real-world target in the United States. But as it turns out, the Department of Homeland Security soon determined that the pump had just burned out. The Wired.com blog Threat Level reported this week that the charge of cyber sabotage was based solely on the fact that a facility consultant was on vacation in Russia when he was asked to advise on a technical issue and responded from a Russian computer. J'accuse! Nevertheless, the fact that there have been no foreign cyber attacks on critical infrastructure here has not quelled fears of cyber war. Jerry Brito, director of the Technology Policy Program at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, says that the heated rhetoric over the issue just doesn't square with the reality. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the case of the water pump, apparently not damaged by Russian hackers, is great for making your case that the cyber warfare threat is overrated. But it's not unreasonable that a foreign state could and would want to engage in that kind of attack, right?
It's certainly possible for a foreign power to use a cyber weapon against the United States. And if you look at what happened to Iran with their nuclear program, it was delayed because their centrifuges were affected by what is now known to be a worm called Stuxnet. And so something like that could certainly happen to the United States. What I'm concerned about is sort of the alarmism that we see in the media and from members of Congress. So, for example, I mean, take Richard Clark, his book called Cyber War, where he talks about what's possible. And he talks about, quote, the collapse of the government's classified and unclassified networks, refinery fires and explosions in cities across the country, the release of lethal clouds of chlorine gas from chemical plants, the destruction of major financial computer networks, et cetera, et cetera. And none of that really is borne out by the evidence.
Yet. We don't want the smoking gun, so to speak, to be the cyber equivalent of a mushroom cloud, if I paraphrase Condoleezza Rice.
Who was saying that about nuclear weapons in Iraq, and how did that turn out?
Turned out to be highly overrated.
And that's just not the way that we should make public policy. We shouldn't make public policy out of fear.
You have pointed not only to the overly hyperbolic language in the intelligence community and in Congress, you also point to uncritical assessments of cyber warfare threats in the media.
In major newspapers like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, we see stories that are anonymously sourced, and they will say things like U.S. infrastructure, including power plants and water plants and, you know, other utilities, are laced with logic bombs that have been left there by Russians and Chinese. And we know this according to anonymous government officials.
What is a logic bomb?
Who knows? This is. I think what they mean when they say logic bombs, is simply a computer virus that could be triggered remotely that would cause the system that it's on to crash. And then what happens is that members of Congress, when they give a presentation before Congress in support of a cybersecurity bill, all the evidence that they put forth are, as the Wall Street Journal reported last week, we are full of logic bombs in our infrastructure. Well, wait a minute. That was anonymously sourced. I'm not suggesting that reporters today are not doing their best and really trusting their anonymous sources. What I'm saying is that we shouldn't trust those anonymous sources. We should demand from Congress, before they pass cybersecurity legislation, examples of why they're doing this.
What's in it for the powers that be in Washington to sell the cyber threat?
If you follow the money, it leads first and foremost to the defense contractors. The defense contractors are the ones who are going to be selling cybersecurity solutions to the federal government. We recently saw the Air Force stand up a new cyber command. There was a big contest to see where it would be sited. Different districts around the country were vying for this. We were making investments in trying to get this cyber command, which would bring with it 10,000 jobs estimated and billions of dollars in spending.
What are we talking about when we talk about cyber warfare? Because Richard Clark can speak to dozens upon dozens of incursions by Chinese and Russian hackers into American security systems all the time.
We're talking about several different things, and they all tend to be conflated, and that's part of the problem. So you have denial of service attacks where a website is taken down. Then you have cyber espionage where you have hackers, whether it's criminal groups or perhaps even state-sponsored, hack into private networks and steal information. Those definitely exist, and they're serious. But what happens is that somebody like Richard Clark, they use examples of these things that we know, and then they say, as a result, we should be worried about trains derailing, planes falling out of the sky. And there you're talking about real kinetic cyber attacks that we have very little evidence for.
What's the harm in passing stringent cybersecurity measures?
Well, that could include telling private networks how they should run their security operations. In many cases, these companies know very well what they need to do because, after all, it's their networks. They know them better than anybody else. And it's not clear to me that a regulator in Washington, D.C. is going to know how to do that.
But this is the same argument that the banks have put forth, and they've done a thoroughly crappy job of regulating themselves. It's the same argument that the health industry has put forth. Is this just an anti-regulatory argument?
There's two things. So number one is legislation that would require private networks to comply to security standards set by DHS. Forces them to comply to one standard, and if they do that, then they're done, instead of actually innovating and figuring out what to do. But secondly, some of the proposals that we've seen would require reengineering of the internet to force people to identify themselves when they log on. That has very big First Amendment free speech implications. But you have other proposals in Congress. For example, there are legislation that require disclosure of attacks. One of the bills that I know that does that is the Safe Data Act, which was introduced by Representative Mary Bonnell-Mack. Right now, you have financial companies and other companies that hold personal information that are breached. And when they're breached, your personal information may be compromised. And what they do is that they keep that to themselves. And so if you require disclosure to say, for example, that Citibank or Sony, as we saw earlier this year, is breached and personal information becomes compromised, they should be required by law to disclose that. And by disclosing that, they are providing information to the market. You and I, when we're shopping for a bank, we're going to take this into account. Consumer Reports is going to take that into account. So that's one way that we could have legislation that would be helpful here by providing more information.
Jerry, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jerry Brito is the director of the Technology Policy Program at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
With election season in full flower, swarms of pollsters have emerged like bees to gauge the fluctuating preferences of American voters. But there are some crucial questions to which pollsters are unlikely to get honest answers. For instance, how much did race factor into your vote for president in 2008? Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, a PhD candidate at Harvard, has found an ingenious way to plumb America's seemingly impenetrable psyche. He sifts through people's Google search results. Just a quick heads up, Davidowitz uses the N-word in the explanation of his research.
We are able to see how often a word is searched over time and in different areas. So basically, I used the most salient racially charged word, nigger, and I'm able to see in what areas of the country this word is searched more often than in other areas of the country.
And you found out that there were significant differences in different places around the U.S.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. West Virginia, for example, the state that searches it the most often, is going to search it more than three times as often as Utah, the state that searches it the least often.
Now, when you say the most, West Virginia is a small state, you mean the most as a percentage of population?
As a percentage of Google searches.
So how do you know when that word is used in a search that it implies some sort of racial animus and isn't a search for a song or for a book report on Huckleberry Finn or what have you?
Yeah. When I initially started the research, I was surprised because I thought that it would be mostly searches for rap lyrics. Rap songs tend to use nigga, the word ending in A, which Google considers a separate search from the epithet ending in ER. So I actually use that as control in my paper. Also, I'm not saying that everybody who searches this, you know, I've seen into their soul and they deep down harbor racial animus. That's certainly not the case, and there are many perfectly benign motivations of searches of the word. The idea is that individuals with racial animus are, on average, going to be more likely to search the term.
You mentioned that the lowest incidence of the search for that word was in Utah, which is as lily white a state as we have in this union.
People were a little surprised to see Utah in the bottom spot. It's actually not inconsistent with some of the other imperfect measures of racial animus. Utah recently has tended to score very low. One might also suspect, if we were going to go based on stereotypes, that individuals in Utah are less likely to use strident language in Google. So in my paper, I control for profane language, and it doesn't really change the results. There's a theory that a number of sociologists and psychologists have developed called racial threat, which is this idea that racial animus can increase the more African Americans you have in the community. I actually found in the data a somewhat more subtle relationship. When there are few African Americans, such as in an area of Utah or Boise, Idaho, racial animus tends to be very low. But then as you have a very high percentage of African Americans, racial animus again gets very low. So I found that racial animus hits its maximum point when an area is between 20 and 30% black, which is not inconsistent with some of the work of other psychologists and sociologists.
So you ran all of this data, and there was lots of it, through your social sciences statistical extruding machine, and you were able to come up with an actual value for what racism cost Obama in the 2008 election. It was pretty striking.
Yeah, about 3 to 5 percentage points of the national popular vote Obama lost. One way to think about it is that racial animus gave Obama's opponent, John McCain, the equivalent of a home state advantage countrywide. So political economists have kind of detected how much advantage a candidate gets from being from a certain home state, and that tends to be about 4 percentage points of the national popular vote.
Now, political polling has always been problematic. It would be great if mining Google or other aspects of social media could replace polling, but does your methodology really expand beyond a few extremely particular situations where honest self-reporting just doesn't take place?
I don't think polls have to worry about going out of business or anything. There are obviously a lot of advantages to surveys for a number of questions. I think Google data will prove useful in a number of areas besides just racial animus.
Give me for instance.
Health will prove a big area. Researchers have used Google data to detect influenza by area. Some scholars say that we can't trust anything in self-reported health data. I think that might be a little extreme, but I believe Google data will prove very helpful on those research topics.
I've got to ask, where are the communities wherein racial animus most resides?
West Virginia. Most of the areas of West Virginia tend to be very high on racial animus. Parts of western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio, southern Mississippi, upstate New York, rural Illinois as well.
And apart from Utah, where are the results most benign?
Laredo, Texas. It's a largely Hispanic area in Texas. Boise, Idaho scores low. Parts of Montana, San Francisco, California, Washington, D.C., Honolulu, Hawaii, Obama's place of birth.
Ha, that's what you say. Show me the birth certificate.
Obama birth certificate is another search term that yields some interesting results.
Seth, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I really appreciate this.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz is a PhD candidate in economics at Harvard.
Pollster lingo for a politician's popularity rating at any given time is favorability. Voters are asked, do you like your public official right now? Pollster Tom Jensen at Democratic polling firm Public Policy Polling recently embarked on a modest quest to figure out who exactly Americans are still able to agree that they do like, because at the moment, generally, they aren't giving the love.
These days, it's pretty much across the board the truth that if you're a Democrat, Republicans hate you. If you're a Republican, Democrats hate you. We've only found three or four senators this entire year who are respected by both Democrats and Republicans. The two who really jump to mind are the women from Maine, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins. For the most part, next year, you're going to see 95% of Republicans voting for Republican candidates, 95% of Democrats voting for Democratic candidates. Americans just really aren't even giving much thought to politicians in the other party.
Okay, here is the lesson that really jumped out at me. As you mentioned, the Maine senators, Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe, were among the most popular politicians in the country, ranking above 65% favorability. These people are resolute moderates, which suggests that the place where people can most agree is on moderate candidates.
And I think that Americans really desire to have an independent candidate, but whether there's an independent candidate who can come up with a message that really appeals to those disaffected moderate voters and has the resources without a party machinery behind them to run a strong campaign is the tough part. You can't survive a party primary this day and age without being pretty liberal if you're a Democrat or being pretty conservative if you're a Republican.
Why did you decide to start polling the favorability ranking for Green Bay Packer quarterback Aaron Rodgers?
Sure. When we go in and poll a state, we certainly ask about the presidential race and the Senate race, but we also like to ask some fun, more offbeat questions. And what we found in Wisconsin is that Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers is viewed favorably by 89% of voters in his state. And at the time, that was the highest level of favorability we'd found for anyone in any poll we'd ever done anywhere.
And you decided to throw out the usual crowd of people you rank to figure out if there was anyone, anywhere, who could beat Aaron Rodgers, right?
After seeing that astounding poll result regarding Rodgers, we went on Twitter, we went on our blog and said, who out there do you think could possibly nationally have better than an 89% favorability rating? And we got a bunch of suggestions, folks like Abraham Lincoln, Jesus Christ, George Washington, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, Steve Jobs, Gandhi, and even Santa Claus.
I assume Santa Claus beat Rodgers?
No, Rodgers actually beat Santa Claus by a pretty good margin. We found that only about 70% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Santa Claus. Clearly, he's got a lot of folks he's going to need to work on in order to get his popularity back to the level where he might want it.
And interestingly, you found that Santa Claus does better with the GOP. You found that George Washington wasn't ranked as favorably among African Americans, maybe because he was a slaveholder. You also found that Martin Luther King didn't rank as highly among whites as he did among blacks.
What we ultimately found in this poll was that only two people nationally did do better than Aaron Rodgers, and those were Abraham Lincoln and Jesus Christ. And the thing that the two of them had going for them was absolutely everybody liked them, no matter what your demographic group was, Democrats, Republicans, white, black, women, men. But then Aaron Rodgers, in his fourth year as an NFL quarterback, did beat out George Washington because of Washington's weakness with black voters. He beat out Santa Claus because of Santa Claus's weakness with Democrats. He beat out Martin Luther King because of Martin Luther King's weakness with white voters. So clearly, leading your team to the Super Bowl will give you a level of popularity that even these folks who we think of as American icons can't match.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Jensen is the Director of Public Policy Polling in Raleigh, North Carolina.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, TJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Doug Anderson, Gianna Palmer, and Lina Anwar. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.